Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Gelton of NPR, sitting in for Diane Rehm. In 2008, historian Tony Judt was planning to write a book about the intellectual history of the 20th century after he was diagnosed with ALS and lost the use of his hands and arms. His friend and fellow historian, Timothy Snyder, offered to help. They met every week for 6 months and recorded their conversations. Just a few weeks before his death at age 62, the editing, introduction, and conclusion of Tony Judt's book in collaboration with Timothy Snyder was finished. The book has just been published under the title Thinking the 20th Century. Timothy Snyder this morning joins me in the studio. Thank you very much, Timothy, for coming in.
Delighted I could do it.
All the way from Yale University, where you are a professor of history, and he's also the author of 5 award-winning books of European history. First, Timothy, tell us about Tony Judt. How long did you know him? How did you know him? What did he mean to you?
I knew Tony from the time when he was a respected but largely unknown historian of France to the time when he became a world-class intellectual. I met him when I'm a generation younger than Tony. I met him when I was a student. I met him just as he was beginning to make his name. Tony was one of our best, if not our best, historians. He wrote a wonderful, wonderful book called Postwar, which managed to bring the histories of Eastern and Western Europe together right at the moment when that was possible in the early 21st century. He was also that very rare thing, an independent intellectual. After he became well known as a historian, he began to pronounce on issues of foreign policy, on the United States national interest, on world affairs generally, in a way which was generally against rather than with the current, and very often he was right. So he was also, to use an old-fashioned word, he was a self-made man. He was a working-class kid, a working-class Jewish kid from South London, scholarship boy at Cambridge in the UK. Then a kind of French intellectual, and then slowly he became an American. He made it all the way to the top in one generation, which is after all, the American dream. But he did it in such a way that he retained a kind of potent individuality the whole time, and that was no more on display than at the very end, when despite a really dreadful illness, which meant that he lost all of the use of his limbs, his voluntary and involuntary muscles, right down to his eyes and his voice, which were what was left when we were talking, right down to the end, he remained his own person. He remained a kind of mastery, retained a kind of mastery over self and over an understanding of the world, which is truly extraordinary.
And he wrote about Europe, he wrote about the 20th century, and his own life sort of reflected the arc of events that he wrote about. So he brought his own personal experience. And one of the things that strikes me about his writing is it was often first person. He often referred to his own experience, particularly in the book that you did with him.
I think one of the things which is hardest about the present moment is that everything is so emotional. As technology brings the world closer and closer to us, the way the world is expressed to us becomes more and more emotional. And so while it's true that Tony did use his own experiences and his own experiences mattered, what impresses me and always will impress me is the way that he reasoned his way through his life. So he's someone who was raised on Marxism. He was someone who was a Zionist for a time. He was Jewish. He had a strong association with France. He was educated in England. But none of these things made him in any simple way who he was. He processed them all. The fact that he went through these various phases helped him to gain a sort of distance, I think an unusual sort of distance, which he combined with really lively writing to give us a very pure and clear sense of where we are.
And then came ALS. Timothy, first of all, remind us what ALS stands for and describe the disease as you saw it develop in Tony Judt.
Well, it's amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, but it's best known as Lou Gehrig's disease. Some people, sports fans, might remember the speech that Lou Gehrig gave in Yankee Stadium where he said he thought he was the luckiest man on the face of the earth. That was a graceful exit into a disease which is utterly debilitating and terribly sad. All that's retained at the end is mental capacity. Lou Gehrig made an exit. That was the last anyone saw of him. The difference between him and Tony is that Tony chose not to make an exit. Tony chose, although he did withdraw into his family and to his closest friends, he chose to continue to work. And what we did and the way that work started was that I proposed to him that once I understood he couldn't use his hands and arms, I proposed to him that we talk a book together, that we work through a book together. And so as his physical condition deteriorated, we continued to talk, and the work actually got better and better as time went on. And Tony, in a remarkable way, even emancipated himself from me and wrote two other books dictating them, all by himself, Ill Fare is the Land and Memory Chalet. And then throughout the entire period of this illness, he continued to work with me, editing these conversations, editing more than a million words of conversation into the book we'll be talking about.
How hard is it to dictate a book? I mean, you know, you've written many books. That's not normally the way books are written, and I have to think it would be a real challenge.
That's a good question. I appreciate that question because it is much more difficult than it looks. Tony was one of the very few people, and this was part of why he was so special, who spoke in paragraphs. You could actually transcribe what he said, and it would look more or less like beautiful prose. That was something special about him, and the fact that he was so articulate is one of the reasons that he's such a loss. The care that he took with the language, the love that he had for the English language, made him special. And I think that's something which I hope this book and his other books can get across. But the reason, one of the ways that we were able to do this was that we both had access to another tradition, the tradition of spoken books in Eastern Europe and France. In Eastern Europe and in France, people do this sort of thing. Those are countries where rhetoric is perhaps more important than it is here, and conversations can take on the form of something which is much more like a book. So Tony and I had references. The very first book he read in Czech was a famous spoken book between a Czech philosopher, a Czech writer, and a Czech philosopher president. One of the books we had in common was a wonderful exchange called My Century between the Polish poet Czesław Miłosz and another Polish poet called Aleksander Watt. And also in Eastern Europe, there's something else that we shared, which is a sort of extravagant idea of friendship, an extravagant idea of intellectual friendship, that you might actually do something in a way excessive like this, something which requires a good deal of discipline, but also a good deal of generosity. That sort of intellectual friendship, I think, is something else which this book expresses, and it's one of the many reasons I'm so glad it exists.
Well, your collaboration with Tony Judd seems to me to have been the epitome of an intellectual friendship, given the circumstances under which he lived in the end. And I do want to talk a little bit more about the disease from which he suffered. And this is something that our listeners may want to join in on. Some of our listeners, I'm sure, have had experiences with relatives or family members who have had Lou Gehrig's disease. You can call us on 1-800-433-8850 or send us your email at drshow@wamu.org. You can also join us on Facebook or Twitter. You know, one of the things, Timothy, that struck me in the way that Tony talked about his disease, and I have to say I didn't realize this, is that there's, first of all, you have sensation. You do not, even though you lose all control of your muscles, it's not as though you're paralyzed in the sense that you don't have any feeling in your body. You still have all the normal sensation and no pain. So that must be a very strange situation to be in with respect to your body.
Well, it's one of the countless ways that this is a terrifying disease, especially if you're someone like Tony, who had spent a life developing a kind of mastery of the world around him, a mastery by way of reading and writing, to be sure, but a certain amount of control, right? If that is your notion, and this is one of the English parts of Tony, if that is your notion of the way of living life, then that loss of control, the ability to take in the world passively, but apparently not to be able to affect it, to control it, to master it, to put it into proportion, to give form to it, that's one more thing which is particularly difficult. But Tony reacted to this not by being humiliated. He reacted to it with humility, which I think is in a way the opposite. He took it, as strange as this may sound, a kind of opportunity to work in a different way. Every kind of artistic work has limits, and his limits simply became far more radical than the limits of other people, or the limits of the old Tony, as he called himself. And he worked within those limits, and within those limits he did something, I think, which was truly extraordinary, which is to take what he had, which was his mind and his memory, and from his memory, from the memory of all the books that he had read, from the memory of the book that he wanted to write about the world of letters, to do this book together with me.
And how was it to work with him physically? You write in the introduction something very poignant. You said you often stopped before you went to see him and washed your hands in very hot water. Can you explain why you did that?
I had to do that because I wanted to be able to shake Tony's hand or grasp his arm or clasp his hand when I entered the apartment. That was important to me. It was just one of the normal everyday ways that you take a situation which is not normal and you make it human. You make it as normal as it might be. I washed my hands so Tony wouldn't get colds in a situation like Tony's, where you can't move, where someone else has to clean your sinuses and so on. A cold, rather than being an annoyance, becomes just one more source of agony, frankly. But the interesting thing is not so much what I was doing in that situation, which was totally obvious and what any decent person would have done. The interesting thing is what Tony was doing in that situation, which was rousing himself for our meetings, mm-hmm. being at his best, being absolutely on top of his game, abstracting himself completely from his physical condition. So the way we always abstract ourselves from the world when we have to think or work, he abstracted himself not only from the world around him, but from his own body, and became himself. I think for those hours when we were talking, he became himself. He focused. That is an extraordinary act of concentration. And it's interesting not only for what it says about him, it's interesting for what it says about what we ourselves might be able to do if we concentrated.
The book that Timothy Snyder and Tony Judd did together is called Thinking the 20th Century. I'm Tom Gelton. We're going to take a short break now. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Tom Gelton, sitting in today for Diane Rehm. And we're talking in this hour about the late intellectual historian Tony Judd and the book that he produced with his fellow historian Timothy Snyder, even though Tony Judd was immobilized by Lou Gehrig's disease in the final 2 years of his life. You can join our conversation. The number is 1-800-433-8850. You can also, of course, email us, drshow@wamu.org. You can join us on Facebook or Twitter. The title of the book, Timothy, that you and Tony did together is Thinking the 20th Century. You know, one of the things that struck me about this title is that you're using the word thinking here in the transitive sense. It's not thinking about the 20th century. Mm-hmm. It's thinking the 20th century. What did you mean by that?
Well, it's the question is what Tony meant by it.
He actually has used that term in that way before, hasn't he?
Yeah, it's a very French way actually of looking at things, that you can think a century, you can think a revolution. The idea is that you're working your way through something, that history doesn't really ever come to an end, that history is something that you continue to process, you continue to think, and by thinking your way through it, by thinking a 20th century, for example, you might come to a sense of what was actually happening, and with that sense of reality, you might then have some traction on what's going on today. It's thinking is something which continues to go on. The century doesn't just recede from us. The century continues to offer itself up to us as a way to understand our own problems.
Now, what was the story that you... Now, I know that Tony wanted to do this book even before he knew he was sick, right? What was the story that you were able to tell in the end? I mean, you did sort of reduce the 20th century to a narrative, to a story. Can you sort of summarize it in a few sentences?
What Tony wanted to do was write a book called Modern Republic of Letters, which was going to be a straight-up intellectual history of the 20th century. And that would have been a wonderful book. It would have been an irreplaceable book, just as Tony's mind was an irreplaceable mind. What we ended up doing was, however, something which I think might be a little more interesting, which is that in talking, we tried to sort out how it was that the ideas of the 20th century attracted and repelled thinkers and how those thinkers mattered, where in the story, Tony himself becomes one of those thinkers. He becomes the Marxist. He becomes the Zionist. He becomes the liberal, the various things that he was. And from my side, I tried to show how those ideas worked on him. I tried to extract that from him in a way he might not have been able to do himself. So we do end up with a history of the 20th century, but it's an active history of the 20th century. It's a kind of participatory 20th century where I hope the reader can read his or her way in to the conversation because it's a kind of lively, active process. The overall story, if there is an overall story, has to do with the state. There are these big ideas, fascism, communism, nationalism, socialism, liberalism. They're all very important. They all have their attractions. They all continue to matter. But if you sift away the ideological surface, if you work your way down to what's really going on, what you really have is a history of the state, what the state should be doing. What are the duties of the state? What are the purposes of the state? Can the state make a society? What should the state be doing? Which strikes me is the key question of the 21st century, and one of the reasons why we have to have our minds around the 20th century to have any idea what's going on around us.
Now, both of you were, in your case, you are so well read, you were able, sitting there spontaneously, to refer to a vast literature on these subjects and talk about authors, talk about books. You know, I think reading this, I got new appreciation for the term off the top of your head, because both of you, and in Tony's case, literally, because his head was all he had left, in a sense, at that point, both of you were able spontaneously to draw on literature, great ideas, great thinkers, great titles of the 20th century. That really is a tribute to your own erudition, I have to say.
Well, I'm not going to say I'm impressed by it, because it's what we're supposed to be doing. That's our line of work. I think if the book has a virtue, it shows how important conversation can be. You know, what Tony and I did, and also what you and I are doing right now, has become rather unusual. We're talking to each other. There's nothing else going on. There are no pictures. There, as long as I don't look at the engineer, there are no lights flashing. We're just talking to each other. And the idea that you can create something extraordinary through conversation, I think, is a message in and of itself. But also that what you have in your mind, it's a very simple idea, but what you have in your mind can only be the things that you've chosen to put in it. So, yeah, I read. That's my job. Tony was extraordinarily well-read. And to concentrate on books means that you then have access to them throughout your life. It means that, paradoxically, because you know something about the past, you have a perspective, you have a solid grounding when you try to figure out the present. What historians tend to think about these things, and Tony and I certainly agreed about this thing, is that if you have these references, it means that the present is not like an earthquake. The present is more like a steady surface. It's more like solid ground. It means that you're never completely lost. You have something you can hold on to try to figure out this difficult reality which is in front of you.
Now, of course, you mentioned before that one of the big ideas of the 20th century was the rise and fall of communism, the rise and fall of fascism, the rise and perhaps we may yet see the decline of social democracy. These trends were a reflection of things, developments in Tony Judt's own life. Talk about that a little bit. I found one of the most interesting sections where he talks about how he was a young man, a kind of an anti-war activist, very much part of the left. And then at some point he discovered a whole part of Europe and a whole part of drama and ideological struggle that he says he hadn't even been aware of before. Mm-hmm. Talk about that and what that what that signified in kind of ideological terms.
Yeah, for me, that was the most exciting part of the book, because what you're asking about is the moment where the biographical part of the book comes together with the intellectual part of the book. So mm-hmm. Tony comes out of a certain sort of West European background where his concerns and his references were first English and then French. And he takes that as far as it can go. He writes about the 20th century in his early work from the point of view of Marxism and its problems, as experienced in places like Paris. But then he does something in midlife, which I think many men are searching for a way to do in midlife, which is to become young again. That he does it in a very productive way. He takes on another biography. Rather than just being the Jewish English kid who learns French, he meets people of his own generation, very often themselves of Jewish background from Eastern Europe. And Tony himself had a grandfather who was from Warsaw. His entire family, if you go back just a couple generations, is from Eastern Europe. And what he did in the 1980s was to come to understand their experiences. So in 1968, he's protesting the Vietnam War from a kind of leftist perspective. Meanwhile, these people who had become his friends are getting beaten by batons or literally being put into prison because they're protesting a communist regime in Warsaw. He is able to, and this is one of the many things which was special about him, he was able to integrate that perspective into his own in midlife. And that was one of the ways that he moved away from his Marxism and moved towards something which I think of as a kind of pluralist liberalism, where you understand that there are very many points of view on European history or on any subject. You can't reduce any difficult subject down just to one thing, whether it's communism or anti-communism. There are a whole lot of relevant points of view, and ultimately you have to start with individual experience. Because he was so good at tapping into the individual experience of others, he was able to think his way across things like centuries and continents.
And he was very critical of the left, the European left, the American left, for not taking seriously enough what had been going on in Eastern Europe. And even in 1968, when he is in Paris as a leftist demonstrator, there are, of course, demonstrations going on the other side of the so-called Iron Curtain. And he says that too many people really paid no attention to what was going on in the communist world at that time.
Yeah, this is one of his productive biases as a historian, that you have to actually take into account what is in fact happening and not just what your ideology predicts mm-hmm. should be happening, whatever your ideology might be. In fact, communism in Eastern Europe was a dreadful thing. It wasn't just that it didn't fulfill the ideas that Western leftists would want. It was, for real people living in real societies, a dreadful sort of experience. And you have to take on board that actual experience if you want to break down a discussion of the world which functions only in terms of ideologies for or against. So taking it up a notch, one of the things which is interesting about Tony is that it's not that easy to pigeonhole him as being on the left or on the right, because you can't take a grab bag of ideas on the left or right and say, yes, he's on this grab bag, or yes, he's on that grab bag. He criticized in all directions, and that's one of the things that made him special.
He wrote about communism that it was the intellectual sin of the century. And tell us what he meant by that. That an intellectual sin, I presume, is something that is done to people's minds.
The intellectual sin of the century, as Tony understood it, was it the attraction to big, attractive, coherent, beautiful ideas about changing the world at some point in the future, but at the cost of killing, torturing, persecuting real people right now. The appeal of communism, and at the time, in the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, even into the 70s and 80s, communism was appealing because it offered a beautiful vision. It offered a group of people you could join to try to realize that beautiful vision, but it also required sacrifice. Tony's objection to communism is precisely that you ought not to be imagining worlds, you intellectuals, that require the sacrifice of people besides yourself. It's a very Camus made a very similar point, actually, in The Rebel. And this is a point which goes beyond communism, right? It's a telling point about mm-hmm. communism, but it speaks to any ideology which has a clear vision of the future. All you need is some sacrifice of other people right now.
I want to go to some of our callers right now, and if you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-433-8850 or send an email to drshow@wamu.org. First, to Kathy, who's calling us from Sarasota, Florida. Good morning, Kathy. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Hi, thank you for taking my call. I actually wanted to know, I'm a student at a college down in Florida, and we're actually discussing life and death. And we just went over a story about a man who also had ALS and how his experience knowing he was dying changed his point of view of everything. And I wanted to know if either member that wrote this book, Tim or the other gentleman, if either of you noticed a different point of view knowing that Tim was going to die, and how you feel like that it might have changed him or changed the way you went about creating this book.
Tony Jutt was, in fact, dying. Timothy, fortunately, is here with us.
Okay.
How did knowing he was going to die change this book or change Tony, Timothy?
Well, I'll just cite what Tony himself had to say about that. Tony thought that, in general, we are quite certain about our own eventual death, but we don't know what's going to happen to us in the next 6 months or the next year. That his position was reversed, that he was quite certain he was going to die very soon, and that therefore he had no control over the other things that might be happening. It did change him. He faced a choice. He was thinking about not working anymore at all. And then he decided that, in fact, he was going to work and concentrate in the way we worked together and also in the way that he worked by himself. His wife, Jennifer Homans, has an article in a coming New York Review of Books where she describes Tony as thinking about the afterlife, not in any spiritual sense, but in the sense that in writing, you help to create the world that is going to be here on this earth after you are gone, that's a perspective you can adopt when you know that you're going to die soon.
Mm-hmm. I'm Tom Gelton of NPR. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. You know, speaking of this, Timothy, I'd like to read something that Tony wrote. It actually was not in the book. It was in one of his New York Review essays. And this is called, this is a little section of something he wrote about night. He talked about during the day, we talked earlier about how he still had all these sensations in his body, even as he was dying. And he said, during the day, he can at least request a scratch, an adjustment, a drink. But then comes the night. I leave bedtime until the last possible moment compatible with my nurse's need for sleep. Once I've been prepared for bed, I am rolled into the bedroom in the wheelchair where I have spent the past 18 hours with some difficulty. I am maneuvered onto my cot. I am sat upright at an angle of 110 degrees and wedged into place with folded towels and pillows. If I allow a stray limb to be misplaced or fail to insist on having my midriff carefully aligned with legs and head, I shall suffer the agonies of the damned later in the night. I am then covered, my hands placed outside the blanket to afford me the illusion of mobility, but wrapped nonetheless since. He says he's offered a final scratch on any of a dozen itchy spots from hairline to toe, and then comes the night. Ask yourself how often you move in the night, he writes. I don't mean change location altogether. Merely how often you shift a hand, a foot, how frequently you scratch assorted body parts before dropping off, how unself-consciously you alter position very slightly to find the most comfortable one. Imagine for a moment you'd been obliged instead to lie absolutely motionless on your back for 7 unbroken hours and constrained to come up with ways to render this Calvary tolerable, not just for one night, but for the rest of your life. My solution, he wrote, has been to scroll through my life, my thoughts, my fantasies, my memories, my mismemories, and the like, until I have chanced upon events, people, or narratives that I can employ to divert my mind from the body in which it is encased. That section to me, Timothy, really sort of brought home what it must have been like to have that malady and to spend those long hours every night absolutely alone, absolutely immobilized. But from that experience and rolling through his thoughts and his memories came a remarkable series of essays, which he then published, recounting specific events in his childhood, his memories, probably at greater length than he would have otherwise been able to do.
We of course won't hopefully ever know just what it's like to have ALS. What we can say is that Tony, in describing his experience of this disease, covered the world, this horrible world, with words in a way which few other people would have been able to do, making that experience much more real and accessible to the happy majority who've never had to suffer any such thing. I think there's another virtue which is worth noticing here, which is that Tony, even at this point, was able to separate out his own experiences from his work as a historian of ideas. As you say, he did write that essay, Death is Remarkable. He did write about his own experiences and his own past. And he and I talked about those things, of course, as well. But that is not at all what our book is about, interestingly enough. Mm-hmm. The book is not about his experience of dying at all. There are some sidelong references to it here and there. But the book is rather a product of this particular moment in his life. The conditions that created it had to do with the disease, but it's not at all about the disease. It's an extraordinary history of the world of ideas as it already existed in Tony's mind, as he was able to call it up at night, but also during the daytime. And I think that's ultimately what's of interest. Not only that Tony was able to describe this dreadful disease in an enviable way, but also that he could work.
Timothy Snyder, he co-wrote Thinking the 20th Century with Tony Judt. Coming up, your calls and questions. Stay tuned.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by America's Natural Gas Alliance, representing the natural gas industry and supporting nearly 3 million jobs across the country. ANGA.US. From PBS, presenting The Amish, A Portrait of Their Faith and Life on American Experience, Tuesday night at 8 on PBS. Local times may vary. And from T. Rowe Price, Understanding the Connections of a Complex Global Economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com. This is NPR.
Journalist Craig Timberg says for years, international AIDS groups overlooked important factors in the spread of the HIV virus, like the effectiveness of circumcision.
The difference between the men who were circumcised and the men who weren't was 8-1 in terms of their infectiousness.
On the next Fresh Air, Timberg explores the history of the virus and efforts to fight the AIDS epidemic. His new book is Tinderbox. Join us.
Welcome back. I'm Tom Gelton, sitting in for Diane Rehm today. Joining me here in the studio is Timothy Snyder. He's a professor of history at Yale University and the author of 5 award-winning books of European history. His latest work is Thinking the 20th Century, which is based on a series of recorded conversations he had with the intellectual historian Tony Judt in the final months of Tony's life. And I'm going to go to the phones now, first to Jorge, who's calling us from Miami, Florida. Good morning, Jorge. Thanks for calling the Diane Rehm Show.
Good morning.
Good morning.
My question is, as a graduate student at Florida International University in historical memory, Tony Judt was a seminal figure in that regard. And my question is, to what extent was he influenced by the French Annales school, and in particular by such figures as, for example, Pierre Nora? And secondly, to what extent did Tony consider, or can we consider, the 20th century as a lieu de mémoire, a site of history, as Pierre and Nora did. And I'll take my response off here. Thank you.
Well, I have a little, very short seminar in graduate history here, Timothy.
Well, these are actually big important questions. Tony was very much influenced by French social historians, especially in the first part of his career, as he tried to sort out how it was that ideas such as socialism could gain traction in political life. But on the bigger question of memory and history, I think Tony was concerned that we keep the two things apart, as you have, I think, quite properly in your question, that we realize that the things we remember, the people we respect remember, people of older generations remember, they're not the same thing as history. They change over time. They're materials from which we make history. And in that way, Tony was actually quite conservative. He thought that memory was a subject of history. It was a source of history, but that it wasn't the only subject or the only source of history. It had its place, but it was precisely a place, that memory has a place. We can't think of the 20th century just as a source of memories. We also have to think of the 20th century as a source of reason, as a source of arguments, which are still going on.
Timothy, your book is about the 20th century. The word Europe does not appear anywhere in the title, and yet your book is almost entirely about Europe. And I'm sure that you know that Francis Fukuyama said critically of Tony Judt that his ideas about Israel reflected sort of a European bias, the idea that liberalism as practiced in Europe could be exported to Israel. You know, also your analysis of the phrase captive mind by Czesław Miłosz reflected, you know, the captive mind as it was experienced behind the Iron Curtain. But what about jihadis who are themselves sort of captured by the ideology of radical Islam? Again, something that you, a very important force in the 20th century, you don't even mention it in your book.
I think it's important to write about what you know. And both Tony and I were historians of Europe. That said, you can draw lessons which continue to be relevant. So Israel is a Middle Eastern country which was founded for the most part by Europeans whose own points of reference were precisely interwar East European politics. There is no way to understand the people who run Israel now without knowing that they come from a tradition in the early 20th century in Eastern Europe of a certain kind of Zionism. You can choose not to know that. You can choose to separate Israel from its European roots, but you're impoverishing your understanding of Israel. When it comes to jihadis or any example of that sort of totalizing thought, Europe offers us ways of breaking that down. It offers us ways of seeing what totalitarian thought was. And the great wisdom, I think, of the kinds of East European thinkers that Tony admired and in some sense was himself, was their conclusion that you simply cannot reduce all of life to any one thing, whatever that thing might be, whether it's an idea of religious salvation, whether it's an idea of a perfect socialist future, or whether it's an idea of a small state generated by capitalism. If you only have one idea, you've got to be wrong.
Well, we have a caller, actually. Now, let's go now to John, who's calling us from Columbia, Missouri, because I think John has a question very similar or reminiscent of one that I was going to ask. John, good morning. Thanks for calling the Diane Rehm Show. You're on the air.
Oh, thanks. Good morning. I listen every day.
Good.
I read Tony's book called Postwar, which is a useful survey of Europe after World War II, and particularly strong in critiquing Soviet sort of puppet states in the East and opposition there. But the one area, and it's a very small area, that I think he was wrong in, is that he seems to have no sympathy or understanding of Irish nationalist opposition to occupation by British forces in the north of Ireland. And I think in that respect, he's like a lot of the British left, is that they just cannot extend their critiques so close to home. And in view of what's happening in Scotland and how that may break away, I find that a weak point in his reasoning.
Timothy?
I'll defer to your knowledge of Irish history, but I would say that Tony was critical of everything with which he had a connection whether that was Britain or Israel or the United States or France. He was critical of everything. That was his way of seeing himself as being an outsider, but also as somehow belonging, that if you care about something, you criticize it. And his critique, actually, of the way that Western civilization is going begins with Britain. I mean, not with Northern Ireland, I admit it, but with the decisions made in the Thatcher years in the 1980s to treat capitalism and the small state as ideals in and of themselves, right? He sees that as the beginning of a process which then spread to the United States and which helped to form the intellectual world in which we live right now. Post-war was more than a useful survey. Post-war was by far the best book on its subject. I think it's unlikely anyone's ever going to replace it. I have points where I fundamentally disagreed with Tony as well. That's what history is about. But it is an extraordinary book.
Now, Jorge mentioned a particular issue, a current issue in Europe that he was curious about Tony's thoughts on. I have to wonder if Tony Judt were still here, what he would be thinking about the euro crisis, which came upon us only in the months after Tony died. You know, I noticed what he wrote about the Marshall Plan from the immediate post-war period after World War II. He said it was primarily a political, not an economic response. The view in Washington was that Europe was so lacking in political self-confidence that it would be unable to recover economically and fall prey to communist disruption or a reversion to fascism. The idea was you had to save Europe economically lest it collapse politically. Boy, we're in the same situation like that right now where Europe is facing, is it not, an existential, not just a debt crisis, but a real existential crisis. What would you and Tony have concluded or talked about with respect to that?
Yeah, I'm sure Tony would have come up with smart things that I'm not going to come up with. But one connection you've made very wisely, I think, is one that he would have made, namely that you have to have statesmanship in times of economic crisis. That economic crisis always is a political opportunity. Both Tony and I saw the Marshall Plan, that is the very wise decision of the United States to help the Europeans economically in the 1940s, as a political move designed to keep both the far left and the far right away and to allow democracies to survive. The question now, I think, is whether Berlin can be as wise as Washington was in the 1940s, whether the Germans can see this as something more than just an economic crisis where you slap the Greeks on the hands and tell them they have to save more money, but rather an opportunity to remake Europe in such a way that it would be fundamentally more democratic. The fundamental problem of the European Union is that there's no fundamental source of democratic political legitimacy for the large-scale economic decisions that are made. And whether this gets patched up or not, that problem is going to continue unless someone does something decisive at this point.
Okay, let's go now to Renee, who's on the phone from Pensacola, Florida. And Renee, I know you've been holding a long time. Thanks for your patience. Thanks for calling.
That's quite all right. It's been perfectly worth it. This is a brilliant discussion, and I want to thank you, Timothy, for coming on the show today. I'm taking notes. I'm almost in tears at some points. You're speaking to my heart because of the way you're describing Tony himself about accepting his limitations and working within those. The fact that, you know, he took this situation, was it normal? And I loved how you spoke about how he abstracted from his body, like we have to abstract from noise. But this mind, I can't wait to read the book. I'm a reading teacher, reading skills at a community college here. And the relevancy that I bring, I talk about current affairs all the time. I want to bring this to my students' attention. But what I wanted to ask, you covered some of it beautifully already about the emotional part of what he had to deal with, especially that part of the book when you read about his going to bed. But I wonder, Timothy, how did your collaboration begin? Did he ever speak to you personally on this level about his disease on a purely emotional level?
Well, you said, Timothy, that the book is very much intellectual, that there's nothing really in there about his struggle with the disease, yet it's certainly something that he had to share with you personally.
Well, the book arose because I understood something very simple about his disease, namely that he had lost the use of his hands and his arms and wasn't going to be able to write in a normal way anymore. The day that I understood that, it was the day that I proposed the book to Tony. I just thought, if this happened to me, I would still want to be able to write, and so I can offer Tony this chance to write. And it goes back to the beginning of your question, Renee, because the other reason why I did it was because I thought Tony had an utterly irreplaceable mind, And it would be a very good thing for us all if we found a way to make sure that that mind could still realize itself, express itself in the world. So the way the book began had everything to do with a little glimmer of understanding in my mind of what the disease was going to be like. And of course, he and I talked about it all the time, just as we talked about all sorts of things in my private life that I'm not going to talk about now. It stared me in the face the entire time. I was speaking to Tony when he was on a breathing apparatus in a wheelchair which he couldn't even direct himself. That was the fundamental physical reality. But the interesting thing, I think, is the way that Tony transcended that reality, those limitations, as you say.
Now, Timothy, you proposed the book, and yet this was a subject that Tony wanted to write about at the end. I get the feeling that, in a sense, this was not just the perfect solution for both of you, but in fact, the book may have come out better as a result of it being, in your words, a spoken book. Do you think so?
I think it was certainly different. I think if Tony had written his history of ideas in the 20th century, it would have been a remarkable, elegant book, and I think that book is a book that we miss. That said, the fact that he and I were in it together meant that I was challenging him in certain ways that he might not have challenged himself. And it's important to see that, that this is not just a matter of my being kind to Tony or Tony being kind to me, because, of course, his company was an extraordinary kindness. There were all sorts of other things he might have been doing with his mind and his time besides talking to me. But it's not just about our kindness. It's about a certain kind of challenge, a certain kind of argument. It's a room where you have two men, you know, each of whom are occupied with the same kinds of ideas, trying to bring out the best in each other. And I think in that sense, it might be better than a traditional book, because you can feel not just the playfulness, but I hope also you can feel the energy and the challenge which was implicit in this sort of thing. Not just the challenge of Tony's limitations, which we've already talked about, but the challenge of dealing with someone else, the challenge of reacting to things, the challenge of adapting yourself to things you might not have thought of yourself.
Now, you say that Tony was very critical of anything that he personally had been associated with. In order to bring out the best in Tony Jott, did you find that you had to provoke him? Did you have to challenge him? Did you have to sort of prompt him into an argument?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Tony and I were always gentle and kind and respectful of each other from beginning to end in our entire friendship. And that's one of the many things that I treasure about it. But it would have been useless to go to him and say, oh, Tony, you're so smart, or oh, Tony, you certainly had this right. The entire book is based upon not agreement. The entire book is based upon argument and discussion. It's not an argument in the way we usually mean the word, where people are upset with each other, but it's an argument in the intellectual sense. The book starts out with the Jewish question. It starts out with the Holocaust, and it starts out with us disagreeing. That's right where the book begins. And it continues that way the whole way through. And I like to think that makes it more interesting as a read, but also that it brings out things in me and in Tony which might have come out otherwise.
Let's go now to Bob, who's calling us from Boston, Massachusetts. Good morning, Bob. Thanks for calling. You're on the Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you very much. Actually, I'd like to say two things. The work itself, as I hear it being described, stands on its own. And I really look forward to reading it. I think we can be so well served by intelligent, I would say courageous people like your guest and the deceased contributor, who can help us look at the world in which we live and really try to come to an understanding that's not just headline after headline after headline. The other thing I would like to say is that my wife, in fact, is challenged by ALS. She's an English professor who, unfortunately, is no longer able to speak. Her disease started with everything in her upper body, if you will, so her speech is gone, and really she can't swallow anymore. But I wanted to say how grateful and moved I am by your guests just describing his dear friend and just the compassion that he has for him, and maybe as importantly, the respect that he maintained for that person. Nothing to do with ALS, I guess I would say. Yeah. In other words, people are exceptional, and I'm just moved by the way your guest worked with this person from a solidly intellectual point of view, recognizing that this is a person who can do exceptional things. I'd like to say the same thing about my wife. I know it's true. And I'm moved by the work you do and how you befriended this person. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Bob, very much for sharing your own struggle with your wife. Do you have anything to say, Timothy?
No, just to thank you, Bob, for sharing that and for using two words which I think were absolutely crucial to the whole enterprise, which are respect and understanding. Thank you very much.
The end, is there anything you can say about the end? I know that Tony, at the end, did in fact begin to lose his ability to speak. Is that right?
So Tony and I did this book in two stages. In the first stage, I was visiting him in New York. We were talking, we were recording. And the second stage was the literary part, where we edited chapters, we sent them back and forth by email, we discussed with each other, we argued each other down to the level of the words. And Tony was doing that as he was reaching the end of his life. When we finished the book in early July of 2010, Tony was still absolutely completely functional in every way, which was relevant to the book. It was only at the very, very end, the very, very end, that he lost that.
A remarkable book, Thinking the 20th Century. I'm Tom Gelton, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Thanks for listening.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Denise Couture, Monique Nazareth, Nikki Jex, Susan Neighbors, and Lisa Dunn. And the engineer is Toby Schreiner. AC Valdez answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from